Welcome to Island Issues, our weekly public affairs program about Hawaii Island's people, issues, and concerns. Brought to you by Regency at Hualalai, a retirement and assisted living community. Listen Sundays at 6:30 a.m. on KKOA 107.7 FM or at 8 a.m. on Lava 105.3 FM. Or to the podcast at lava1053.com or koacountry1077.com. Now here's your host and producer, Sherry Brackett.
Aloha, good Sunday morning. Welcome to Island Issues. Today I have the privilege to talk with our state's newly elected Lieutenant Governor, Josh Green. Good morning, aloha, Dr. Green.
Good morning, Sherry. Great to see you.
For those who don't know him, Dr. Josh Green was born in New York and raised in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He moved to Hawaii in 1997 after completing medical training in South Africa. That's when he began his life's work as a family physician and emergency room doctor in rural hospitals. He ran for state representative in 2004, representing the Kona District, and then became a state senator starting in 2008, representing the west side of the Big Island. On December 3rd, Dr. Josh Green will be sworn in as the state's lieutenant governor, serving with Governor David Ige, and will be the first lieutenant governor from the Big Island. I suspect that of maybe equal importance, maybe more, Josh Green is a physician and has worked as an emergency room physician on the Big Island, first at Kau Hospital and now at Kohala Hospital, on weekends, even while serving in the state legislature. By the way, that's where we are today, Kohala Hospital. So, Dr. Green, thank you so much for taking time to talk. This has to be a pretty exciting time, but also sort of a daunting time. Serving as lieutenant governor is a very big job, or it can be a very big job. It really depends on the definition, and can, in fact, set the lieutenant governor on a path for additional higher legislative positions, either in the state or in the United States Congress. But for now, reflect on this opportunity to be the state's lieutenant governor.
Well, it's really quite an honor, and in many ways, a wonderful shock to the system. I had thought for a long while that if I did a decent job or a good job as a state senator for our home in Kona, that at some point I'd like to take a larger leadership role. The opportunity came and my family and I went all in for it, and we're honored to get enough support to win the primary and then the general. So when I say it's a shock to the system, it's a lot more responsibility, but it's something that I wanted and I'm excited about, to take on big challenges statewide, like homelessness, like the opioid crisis, like the physician shortage, where I could only do a smaller amount as a senator.
You know, one of the, I will say, jobs of the lieutenant governor is to serve while the governor is out of state, if he becomes ill or if, heaven forbid, he should pass away. So the question is, are you ready to be governor if you need to be governor?
I'm ready today, actually. When I was going through the process of the campaign, which was over a year, a lot of times I was able to reflect on, would I be calm under pressure? Would I be able to step up? And you learn a lot of lessons talking to people, and you observe a lot of the way people are governing. And I just developed a certain comfort level sometime in the midsummer. I don't know what clicked, but I knew then that if I was ever called on in need, I'd be ready. And I also think, and I've talked about this with my family, they seem to think that it's my kind of steadiness as an emergency room doctor that makes me not worry or panic about what could come. Now, as a doc, I'm going to take good care of my gov. You know, I'm going to make sure David's in good health, and he's going to be our governor for, of course, this whole term. It's going to be fantastic. But whenever needed, I'll be ready. And as lieutenant governor, I intend to be a much more vibrant lieutenant governor than we've ever seen before. I look at it as a partnership, not as a tier one, tier two responsibility for the executive branch. I'll always defer to the gov because he's earned the position to run the whole state. But there are areas where I have a lot of expertise, and I'm guessing we're going to touch on some of those today. There are areas of expertise that hopefully I can really be a large complement to what he is. He's an engineer. I'm a doc. His wife is an educator. My wife's a lawyer. We have a lot of excellent synergy. Some people think it's an odd couple, but it really actually is a nice partnership. And as we get to know each other, I think he'll have a large role in mind for me.
Reflect on the significance, if there is a significance, to being the first lieutenant governor from the Big Island, and really one of the few lieutenant governors ever to be elected who was not from Oahu.
Well, that is a great pleasure to me, because I consider Big Island my roots, and I always will. When I came to the Big Island to work in the National Health Corps, I was immediately incorporated as a family member to the people of Kau and then Kona and then Hawi. So all of this side of the island, south all the way to north. And so I have a ton of Hanai family, and being able to be a lieutenant governor from the neighbor islands in general, but specifically Big Island, means I'll have extra focus on Big Island. There are key issues that the Oahu guys never really fully grasp the impact on us, like, for example, we'll probably talk about this in more depth, but rat lung, what it means when a volcano goes off and displaces 600 or 800 families, what it means to have some constant seismic activity in parts of the island, what it means to have twice the number of shortages on healthcare and nursing. Those are things that I'll be able to constantly be in the governor's ear about and continuously remind him and the cabinet, because I'll be at every cabinet meeting, that there are needs that the neighbor islands and the Big Island have that are pretty much a mystery to the Oahu folks. And so I think it's a great thing. Having a partnership where one person's from the neighbor islands and one is from Oahu is probably the right way to do it.
You know, Dr. Green, being a physician is inherent to who you are. And even during the campaign and, well, for the last 21 years, you've worked as an emergency room physician, even once you became in the state legislature. So the question is, with the new duties, do you expect you'll be able to continue being an emergency room physician here on the Big Island?
That's kind of the big question that we've been going over with my family, and let me give you a pretty thorough answer on this. After a lot of soul searching, I just decided I am a doctor at my core. That is what people saw in me when they chose me. They elected me in large part because I have the capacity to be empathetic and to really know people's challenges. And it was through the lens of being a doctor all these years that I think I was able to better understand our challenges. So the short answer is yes, I'm going to still be a doctor. And yes, I'm going to come back, I believe, probably one weekend a month on my own personal time. I've asked to make sure that that's okay. I've been reassured that there's no problem as long as I have backup immediately if I'm called into need. It's not unlike other personal time. People would go to first birthdays or gatherings or funerals or some ceremonial events possibly on the weekend. I'm just going to choose to have one of my weekends be in service. And I would like to do it in the rural areas because I've asked many hundreds of people how they felt about that. And I would say it has been virtually unanimous that people think that if I continue to have that perspective, just a lot less. I've been working in general 6 or 7 24-hour shifts a month forever, and I'm going to shrink it down significantly just to one weekend. The other times I'm a doctor, I'll volunteer in homeless clinics on Oahu and across the islands, I believe, to just do wound care and that kind of thing to work on a problem. But to still be an emergency room doctor, I think, will continue to make me relevant from the private side. And if it turns out to be burdensome or takes away one iota of focus from being lieutenant governor, of course I would give it up. But I think it's going to make me a better lieutenant governor rather than one that's distracted. And I love the Big Island, so this is the way I can really keep my roots here.
We are recording this interview at Kohala Hospital, and as I was driving up here, I was reflecting, your background truly is in rural medicine. Kau Hospital and Kohala Hospital are both at least 30 miles from the nearest level 3 trauma center, whether it's Kona Hospital, Hilo Medical Center, or North Hawaii Community Hospital. What is it that has drawn you to rural medicine, which clearly has more challenges? I mean, you don't have the capability in either Kau Hospital or Kohala Hospital to have all the high-tech equipment and the immediate access to everything you might want. So tell us why rural medicine has been your focus.
Really, it's a question of need. When I was chosen by the National Health Corps to serve, most of the areas were rural that had the greatest need. There were some urban settings, but there's still a lot of backup. That was more of a question of people who are in poverty and in an urban setting needing help. And I totally see the value in that. But once you get rural, you see how great the need is. It's always twice or three times greater. Just before you and I started this interview, I had a patient that was quite ill who came in that would normally get specialty care, but without having our little hospital here and a doc very nearby, he would have gotten nothing. And so I value that. It can be more challenging, although after many years, I'm pretty comfortable with what has to happen in a rural setting. We still have a heavy reliance on the bigger facilities, transferring people when they need a lot more care, specialists involved, surgery. But we do a lot in the rural areas, and I just plain like the pace and kind of the gentle nature of the community. So I think rural communities deserve solid, well-trained professionals too. And so we're building that system out, and that's going to be a big part of what I do for the whole state as Lieutenant Governor.
My focus today really is what you're going to do as Lieutenant Governor, but first I want to get this one question out of the way. Much was made during the election, particularly the primary election, of the fact that the Carpenters Union Political Action Committee, which was called Be Change Now, I believe, spent more than $400,000 in ads to promote your candidacy. And I know that legally they cannot have any coordination with you nor your campaign. But now we're done with the campaign. So tell us what your relationship is and will be with the Carpenters Union, what meetings you might have had with them. Just give us the lay of the land on this one, because there's been a lot of talk about this.
I think that's a really fair question. The run-up through the primary was a blitz, of course, of interesting support and opposition from all across the state. You know, I was honored, and I think you've heard me say this a little bit before, I was honored to have the support of the teachers, for instance, and the carpenters, and the nursing association, and the medical association, and then the Sierra Club, and group after group after group saw me walking door to door like I did in Kona all these years, which you saw personally. They saw me still working full-time as a doctor. And so a lot of groups supported me, even though I had opposed their big issues. Your listeners should know, and I think they probably do, I actually voted against the rail because I didn't think we should be taxing neighbor island communities like ours in Kona to pay for a large project. I thought it was the inappropriate mechanism that they put out. So I voted against it, yet I still got endorsements from groups like the Carpenters because they felt I had a lot of integrity and I was tough enough to stand up for what I thought was right on behalf of people. So, like I said, I was endorsed and supported by so many groups that was just one of them. And you also said quite clearly, which is accurate, you have no control when you're a candidate over these relationships. If they endorse you and spend money, that's just part of the political system. It is a reality that exists right now, and maybe it'll go away someday. So I had no control over that. I intend to have a very good relationship with builders because I think we need to build a lot of housing to get through the homeless crisis. I'll listen carefully, but I'll also be analytical about things. I always make sure that if there's a problem with someone's proposal, whether it's the carpenters or the teachers or some other group, the environmental community that proposes something, my first responsibility is to the people of our community. I'll always be learning and listening. So that's how I'll approach things, and I hope people will really see that I'm an independent soul.
Have the Carpenters Union representatives asked you for anything?
They haven't asked me for anything, no. I think that they see that this is a long process, that they want to work with the entire government. They're kind of more focused on the city and county elections, but I'm going to include them in the dialogue, and if they have good people that can contribute ideas, I'll listen and I'll include them, just like I'll include teachers, and I'm probably going to reach out heavily to the Hawaiian community. I want someone from each of these sectors to be contributing. I don't have a big team, but I want people involved that know the big issues. I always have a pretty good handle on the health issues, and so I don't really have to add people from the health sector to give me perspective. But setting that one aside, I will always want to take from the biggest issue points somebody who knows, so I can have a rigorous debate and constantly push back on what the best solutions might be.
The Lieutenant Governor's job is a little bit loosely defined. I mean, the job is mostly clerical things like issuing state IDs and marriage licenses and things like that. And typically, Lieutenant Governor has clerks who do that. So that leaves a whole lot of options. And I know that homelessness and homeless housing and homeless health has been a big focus of yours. Just so listeners know, just to draw you back to a discussion we had with Art Ushijima, who is the CEO of Queens Medical Center. And we talked with him probably a year ago. And he noted that at that time they were spending more than $18 million in the Queens emergency room to treat homeless folks. And usually if it was for chronic diseases or minor things, but they did not have primary care physicians. So Art was extremely, well, he was just filled with praise for you, Dr. Josh Green, because he said you had established a way on Oahu to address the homeless health issues and also the housing. So tell us about that project. what it is and how it might spread to other islands, because clearly we have homeless issues here.
Yes, that's going to be a signature focus of mine and project that I'll take up from the Lieutenant Governor perch, and that is creating this new model to deal with chronic homelessness. What Art was referring to, and he is a terrific leader of Queens Hospital and statewide, was the H4. In brief, that's hygiene, healthcare 24/7, medical respite was health and housing, third H, and then permanent housing, the fourth H. So we call it H4. We've already started the satellite clinic in Chinatown, and we're already seeing dozens and dozens of people every week, decreasing the burden on Queens, decreasing the cost to the taxpayers. We're saving well over $100,000 a week, and we're going to be doubling that in the near future as we increase our capacity. We've already also begun to establish a foothold in Kailua to do medical respite.
And that's Kailua on Oahu.
On Oahu, yes, thank you. And I hope to do about six of those statewide, and then the largest hub, which we have to wait and get the final approval from city and county, which would give us that full capacity. If we do it right, and we take care of the many hundreds to thousands of individuals who have addiction, mental illness, and are homeless, we can save hundreds of millions of dollars. I think over $300 million can be saved per year because we don't have that revolving door. People get hurt or sick in the streets. They go by ambulance to the ER. The ambulance is $1,050. The ER is over $1,000. The stay overnight is $2,000. We had one gentleman named Gary. He went to the hospital 241 times last year and spent over $1.2 million. There are a lot of individuals that are some permutation of Gary, and they really could be helped by just having housing, dropping their costs more than 40%, and their life improves. So I'll be using that model with private sector investors and probably some state support, depending on how the governor wants me to approach it, although I have that in mind, because by having this hybrid model, getting a state facility that's already there, that's otherwise not being used, and the private sector investing because they see savings, it really helps the taxpayers, and more than anything, it helps the families who are homeless. So remember, every homeless person has some mom somewhere that's really having heartache because their kid is homeless. So it could be a 40-year-old kid, it could be a 22-year-old, who knows, but it's still a homeless person who's suffering. So that's going to be a huge focus, and that blends into some of the other issues I'll focus on, like opioid addiction, which often comes hand in hand with homelessness, and mental illness and access to mental health care, which, once again, we have a severe shortage of psychologists, psychiatrists, facilities that hopefully as a neighbor island legislator, I can make it really clear to people how big a deal it is for us and how it should be solved because it's just good healthcare and good economics.
One of the things I'd heard was that a key to the success on Oahu was that the city and county was in fact providing physical facilities, housing. I'm looking obviously only at the Big Island right now, but we clearly need what you're talking about. What's necessary from the county's standpoint so that you can fulfill what you're talking about?
So I have spoken briefly with the mayor, and he's completely cognizant of the issue, of course. We have what's called the Ohana Zone appropriation, which we did last year at the state legislative level. That gives each county some access to resources. Then we need the county mayors to choose which part of their county is most in need, because if they give us a building or a site that is already got some infrastructure, it's not nearly as costly, and we can use that money then to pay for some minimal structures, micro housing, depending on what the community needs, but also the social work, the support, the security, the healthcare, because those are the high cost items when not tended to. So that's how it has to be approached, and the mayor knows. Also, of course, because we have so many people displaced in Puna as a result of the volcano, we're now just seeing how that settles out. If we find that that's a major hub, then I think it's probably going to be Kona and Puna that have the greatest need with some support for Hilo. The best idea is to have an impact on those who are really suffering and who are also very costly as homeless individuals, because then when you save the money, you can do all kinds of things for people who are not quite as bad off but needs some basic shelter, who needs some basic services. Healthcare is the largest cost, that's the biggest hit. And then of course also crime and violence has an enormous impact, which we have to stop because that can also be very disturbing and disruptive to society, and you can't even calculate the cost when someone's been injured. It's just too much to bear. So that's how I approach it. I think that after I am sworn in on December 3rd, I'll be spending a lot of time with the mayors around the whole state. I won't be surprised if, though we've had some conversations, if the governor wants to more formally designate me to be the point person on some of these issues, particularly chronic homelessness and addiction.
What have you and the governor talked about? What will be your focus? I mean, can this housing, homeless, health issue be your focus?
Yes, actually. And we've spoken many times already. We have an extremely good relationship. I just plain like the governor. Getting to know him, it was very clear to me that he's a very humble person and he doesn't like to jabber on. He likes to actually be analytical about things. He is an engineer at heart. He's not a typical politician, and we have spoken very directly about things I'd work on. He's openly saying that me working on chronic homelessness, opioids, and the physician shortage are three areas that he sees that I can have some great capacity. We have to integrate me into some of the work he's already doing, which I've already been integrated into as a state senator and the chair of the Human Services Committee. So I'm completely familiar with what the team is doing, but I don't want to tread on the turf of people who already have good jobs, directors of health, human services, his homeless task force, Scartmore Shiggy. But I also bring a different perspective, that of the health component of chronic homelessness and the health prevention piece on the ground in rural communities for opioids, where they often are a big challenge, even bigger challenge than some places urban. So I think that integration will be important, but we haven't been shy about talking about these things. And I think there's going to be a lot of other issues. I want to work on climate issues, for instance, and there's some good people working on it long-term, going to have a big impact on the state of Hawaii. I want to work on retaining teachers. We have a lot of great people at the Department of Education, but they don't often get to focus on that kind of thing. And so what people have historically said might not be a clear description of the job and role of lieutenant governor. I tend to take that as an opportunity and straight up decide three or five things that I can be impactful on, work closely with the governor to be kind of let loose on these problems, and then go after them for 4 years. So I'm banking on that flexibility to actually be a help.
You know, Dr. Green, future Lieutenant Governor Green, one of the things we have talked about in the past, and you've kind of touched on, there is a brand new director of the Department of Health.
Yes.
We have an ongoing outbreak of rat lungworm disease. We had an outbreak of dengue fever. Most people on the Big Island felt both of those things have not been well handled. So the question is, you said you don't want to step on people's toes, and that's understandable, but do you expect and how do you plan to influence the Department of Health when we have those things occur? Right now, rat lungworm needs way more attention than it's getting, and I imagine we probably will get another dengue outbreak at some point, maybe even Zika.
Well, I'm going to be the first person on the ground with the Department of Health as a lieutenant governor, as a person whose roots are here in Big Island. I'm going to be here in the trench, and I'm going to be reporting straight back to the governor without anyone in between us. And that's going to be a big advantage for us, I think, from an appropriation standpoint, from deployment of resources standpoint. It changes things when you have an embedded super advocate, and that's kind of what I can be. And I have health experience, so if it's Zika or if it's rat lungworm, then I can say, okay, let's get the CDC in here. I have them on the phone. I'm going to be lieutenant governor and a physician, and I'm going to get straight answers immediately and then have that resource brought to bear. So we won't have the kind of separation that we often have had before. Sometimes that's just a lucky break. If your elected official ends up in a certain position, it's good for your community. But we have need, and I'll apply need anywhere in the state, but my heart is with Big Island even a little more than usual.
An issue that has come up fairly recently is the whole issue of vaping. The FDA has now said that vaping is an epidemic among our young people. Just last week, my interview was with folks from the Hawaii Public Health Institute, Sally Anchetta and Forrest Batts and Kevin Ramirez, about the fact that our state has more vaping among young people than any place in the country, and the Big Island has more than any place in the state. A really sad commentary. There has been an attempt in the past to get the state legislature to pass more stringent laws relative to vaping. Is that something that you plan to influence, given the severity of what appears to be a true epidemic among young people? Because I just want to remind everybody, vaping materials, they have nicotine, and kids are getting addicted.
Right. They have nicotine and other chemicals. They can even have illicit drugs put into the vaping. So it's absolutely a priority because, number one, vaping will lead to nicotine addiction, which will lead to smoking. And we did a really good job. Hawaii is probably the number one leader on smoking cessation, blocking smoking from adolescence. We moved the age to 21. I mean, we did some stuff that nobody else has really done. But now vaping is the big tobacco way of getting into the culture and society before people can even get their hands on cigarettes. So we'd be wise to stop vaping as an industry altogether in the state of Hawaii, put up every possible barrier to young people getting it. It should be more expensive, prohibitively expensive for young people to try to start. It's just not good for society. And anyone who argues that it's used effectively as a way to get off of smoking is just spinning a yarn. I don't really think that that's what it's about. I think it's about selling nicotine again. People are vulnerable when they're young, especially to addiction and getting started. We will have strong health leadership in the legislature on this. I know the previous chair is still on top of this and has a great concern about vaping. The human services chair that will replace me is a good friend, Russell Ruderman. When that goes to his committee, I'm going to ask them to really up the ante on enforcement so that it's tough for adolescents to get a hold of the stuff. People are vaping in and out of schools, near schools. Goodness knows what's in there. And they're going to have other health problems. Cardiovascular consequences and, you know, so it's blood pressure issues and heart issues. So it's just not a good direction to go in. I'm not going to be the new director of health and lieutenant governor, but I am going to be fortifying the Department of Health with that kind of legislative background that I have. And I think that I bring a lot of things to the table I hope that people will appreciate. So it's a big problem, and it's one of the emerging public health issues that will be all over. I look at a lot of public health issues that I'll be passionate about, both locally and nationally, by the way. I intend to take up a serious discussion about gun violence. We're seeing more gun violence on Oahu, and I see that as a public health concern. And I don't want it to be a partisan issue. I don't tread on people's Second Amendment rights, but what I do say is there has to be protection for people, and we have to support our law enforcement. And we also have to be mindful that these are health questions for a lot of people. Mental illness is very serious. Drug addiction is very serious. And if someone has a gun and we haven't done an adequate job helping them and checking to see whether they're safe to have a serious weapon, we haven't done our job as a society. So I'm going to look at this, say to myself, when you have 60 or 70,000 people who die, for instance, of gun violence, how much do we spend on diseases where 60 or 70,000 Americans die a year? How much prevention do we put in? How much public awareness? How much safety considerations do we make? And we should do the same or more for guns. I intend to take up issues like that. And they all do in some ways come together from my perspective as a physician. Where I see parts of society suffering, I quickly pivot to how I can help from a prevention standpoint or from a healthy standpoint. And I'll continue to do that with these kind of big issues. Because again, it's not partisan politics. It's kind of health politics and it's advocacy, which I enjoy. So I'm going to be working very hard on these public health questions, on homelessness, on actually affordable housing, which the governor has made a big focus of his first and now coming second term. A lot of progress is being made, which you'll see the results of in this next 2 years. So Hawaii will do well in the next 2 years, but who knows what will come? Will there be another volcanic eruption? Will there be a public health crisis like dengue? Will there be a large concern about traveling to the islands and we see tourism change? These are things that can happen quite quickly. I've been watching closely for these 14 years in office. I study these problems, and with the perspective that I have, I hope that I'll be a major addition, because I don't think we've gotten out of our lieutenant governor position probably what we want. Good people in there, but for whatever reason, the dynamic didn't result in a lot of heavy lifting, and I'm going to be lifting a lot of heavy problems.
You mentioned one of your goals will be to retain teachers. There was a lot of discussion about education funding when there was a proposed constitutional amendment that would have allowed the state to tax real properties in all the counties, a right that is currently reserved to the counties. Although the state Supreme Court struck that amendment down before it even got voted on, people were not pleased with it because it was extremely general. It never said what the money was going to be used for, which properties would be taxed, how much. So I don't think anybody, though, in any of the forums that I moderated, nobody said they didn't want to help education, but this was just not the way. Part of the problem was the Department of Education would not come forward and say what their needs were. We invited them to the forums. I asked them to tell me privately so I could share that. No, they didn't want to talk about it. How do you and the governor plan to approach the whole issue of making sure our education system, particularly K through 12, is more robust?
So you bring up a lot of great points. it was problematic to have a constitutional amendment that wasn't totally clear for people. We do have to provide more resources to keep teachers, but maybe some of those resources are already contained in the Department of Education. So a comprehensive assessment audit of the DOE, whether it's done internally by the governor's team or by the auditor, I think that's coming from what I hear from the legislature. I think that it's fair. I don't think anyone is shy or afraid of doing a full assessment. There's a lot of resources that can be found. The governor's been talking about that quite a lot during the campaign. He feels that there are many millions of dollars that are not being captured through our tax system, that certainly a lot of people are skirting the system with illegal rentals. They need to pay their fair share of the tax if they're doing home rentals, Airbnb, and that kind of thing. So as revenues come in, I'd like to see a hunk of that revenue go towards teacher retention. For one reason, every time we have to train a new teacher, it's probably $100,000 to $150,000 of retraining resource that goes into that. And if we lose our teachers every 3 or 5 years, we've spent an awful lot training a teacher for some other state, which we shouldn't do. We should train them for our state. Just like we were able to retain me as a physician by paying my loans back. And here I am with you after 20 years, and I'm still this minute in the rural setting practicing, which means that investment has paid off many hundreds of fold over because I'm able to deliver care this morning and tonight and next weekend and so on. So that's got to be the model. I've proposed some basic teacher retention programs, much more significant at 5 and 10 years, to pay back loans, to help teachers perhaps pay down their mortgages so that they have very clear incentive to stay. As we all know, property is really expensive. But if you can get a grip on your mortgage here and the salaries might be a little lower than the mainland, people do want to stay and live here. So these are the kind of things that could make a difference. But it can't be a dart thrown at the board. I think it's going to have to be a smart, solid plan. The teachers were very clear in their needs to retain teachers, and they have about 1,000 opening spots every year, and then they have to fill them with people who aren't trained. And they're cognizant of that. They don't want to have undertrained teachers in their midst. It's a complicated problem, but it's something I'm interested in. And then there's pre-K education, which pays dividends, but you have to afford it. My office is going to work on a deep dive into what education should look truly like in the 21st century. I do not think that a single track for all students makes sense. And I know there's been some discussion about more tech tracks and this and that, but some students are really ready for community college at a much earlier age. Then they can, as the governor's pointed out very well, have less debt because they get those credits while they're young and while they're still in the public education system. Other students can quickly track to internships, again, in junior high school and high school, to prepare them for excellent jobs that pay $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 a year, but don't require them to be 4 more years in the public school classroom. They can get their degree still. So things have to change a lot. Obviously, the internet age has changed the way students approach education. So I think a lot is going to change, and it will create some opportunities to have more resources available that we didn't have before. Do I think there's going to be a lottery or a new tax? I would doubt that right now, but we can't continue to underpay teachers.
You know, there's way more to the problem than just the pay the teachers get. When I spoke with some teachers and administrators who were willing to speak with me off the record in advance of the forums about the education amendment, they said there's issues about the testing and about the evaluation of teachers and all that. Will that be part of your focus as well, just the whole look at it?
Well, I think there should be a lot more autonomy in the classroom for the teachers and for the principals. I think that class size, smaller class size, is relevant. And I think just always targeting a test is a bad way to approach education in general. It's not how I was educated, and I had a lot of good education in public schools. It's not based on tests. I went on to scholarships in med school, and, you know, it worked pretty well. So I prefer liberal arts education. I prefer some arts in the schools. I think that makes for a well-rounded education and a better system. Also better prepared young people. So there's a lot of work to be done. And it's very possible the Lieutenant Governor's office can be a place that brings experts. I've already talked to some governors from other states. They've retired. They're going to be a part of some of the work I do as far as very high-end think tanks on especially homelessness and addiction to start. They're physician governors from the past. Governor Kitzhaber, Governor Dean have become friends. And so having expert advisors in an office that's got a lot of capacity and where I can take some of the workload off of Governor Ige's desk, especially if I have expertise at an issue, is what I'll do. It'll be interesting. It'll be interesting if they see me almost exclusively as a healthcare expert, and a social service expert, or also as a person with a breadth of experience. And you touched on it earlier, I'm going to have a Big Island focus. I'm going to have a health and human services focus with homelessness. But some other big issues may emerge out of the Lieutenant Governor's office that will surprise people. And as long as the governor is feeling comfortable with me, I think it'll be a great relationship.
You're going to get a lot of requests from people, particularly on the Big Island, to do everything. Solve the Mauna Kea issue, take care of affordable housing, deal with the lava flow, deal with agricultural issues. You can't do everything, even though folks will think that you can. How do you expect to handle all of that? Because you know you're going to get those kind of requests.
I do know. I will be overly generous with every last minute that I've got because I just love it. My family is relieved that I'm not going to have quite so much medical work to do, so that opens up a lot of capacity for me. Probably look a little bit better rested some days. You know, I'm aware of the responsibility, and I asked for it, and I wanted it. So I'm going to take it very seriously. I'm going to work tirelessly for these next 4 years. I will put in overtime and super overdrive for the neighbor islands and for homeless solutions, no matter what. But I have a big staff coming, and that staff is going to include people who know how to build houses and who know how to address education. I have one or two educators coming. I'm going to bring a person on who has a great wealth of experience on Native Hawaiian issues so that I have some insight into the TMT dialogue that's been going on in a way that I can't, as a person who came here just 20 years ago, wouldn't have. So I want that breadth. I'll have about 10 people. And then there's just the pure job of Lieutenant Governor to do some basic important functions that seem mundane, but you know, if you're getting adopted or if you change your name and if you need to get your marriage certificate handled, we're going to be on those kind of things too, because I want to do my part. That's the job of the Lieutenant Governor. But in addition to that, I intend to think big and make a lot of solutions come out of the Lieutenant Governor's office. So I'm very excited. I'm excited just to have a life change. I'm 48 years old. You got to know me when I was quite young. I think I was 33 when we first met. And it was just a great experience and an honor to be the representative for Kona, the senator for West Hawaii. I can't imagine a better way to have come up and learned the jobs. People have been so great. I want to thank Big Island if I can. I won the election because Big Island backed me so hard. I didn't even really campaign here. I just took care of 40,000 people as a doctor over the years, and people got to know me, and it was a different kind of politics. And so we won that election. Many people all across the state supported me, but I want to be fair. Big Island was super supportive, and they've given me this honor, and so I'm going to make sure I pay back that honor by spending extra time here and extra focus on our issues.
Dr. Josh Green, incoming Lieutenant Governor, thank you so much for your time today. Aloha.
Aloha. Thanks again, Sherry.
And to our listeners, thank you so much for being with us. This is Island Issues. I'm Sherry Bracken, your host and producer. I'll see you next Sunday morning for another Island Issues. Until then, please, let's all live and drive with aloha. Ahui ho.
Thank you for listening to Island Issues, brought to you by Regency at Hualalai, a retirement and assisted living community. We welcome your comments and suggestions. Email us at info@lava105.com. Join us again next week for another Island Issues, a service of Hawaii Islands Mahalo Multimedia.